you were talking about the you were talking about your bus, and you miraculously got a tyre and tube. How much sleep were you getting a night at that time? Were you?
Oh well, you wouldn't get a great deal, Michael. The conditions wouldn't allow you to sleep a great deal. One thing that might be an interesting point was that that chappie who became my helper, you talk about sleeping, Jock Ingalls, I've never in my life heard a man snore like he did. When I first contacted him and he had occasion to sleep near my tent in Palestine, I got him there before we went up for a trip around the Holy Land, and well, I couldn't sleep because of his snoring. And when he was appointed as my helper and we went down to the Western Desert, we were sleeping in a dugout on this occasion. Padre Pat Whelan was in his shelter just near us. We had slept there together, at least in the same building. But on this occasion, we were in the dugout, and Jock snoring, he'd snore and he'd chew his teeth, and it was something shocking. And I went up the passageway out of the dugout, and I slept on top of the dugout in the sand. And in the morning, Jock said to me, "Well, what did you go up there for? Do I snore?" "Oh," I said, "you do a bit." So Jock said to me, "Well, okay, tonight you go down in the dugout and I go up there," which he did. And in the course of, I would say, a week, Jock would sleep like a baby. I've never contacted anything like it in my life. And then, well, of course, he came back down into the dugout and Jock would sleep like a baby, and he did all the time we were together, until there came the need for him to go to hospital. He broke out in sores, what they called WOG sores. And I persuaded him finally to go to the medical post, and it finished up that he went to hospital. When he came out of hospital, he was as bad as ever. He snored again, something frightful. And I said to him, "Jock, you know, nobody, the fellas could never have got asleep at the hospital with you going on like that." And he said, "Oh," he used to call me Adji, my rank at that stage was adjutant. He said, "just give me a night or two." Well, within a day or two, Jock was right back to normal. He would not snore. And I said to him, "How do you do it?" And he said, "Well, when I go to bed," he said, "I say to myself, you must not snore, you must not snore, you must not snore." And this sort of thing on that man's mind cured him. Amazing. Absolutely cured him. Yeah. Never seen anything, found anything like it.
Extraordinary.
I visited him after the war in Sydney, and I stayed at their place one night. His wife was away at the time with a nervous breakdown. And Jock snored just like he did in the Western Desert.
Mm.
And I said, "Look, Jock, I couldn't sleep last night." I said, "If you treat Ivy with that," I said, "I can understand why she's on a nervous breakdown." But no, most nights, under the conditions, sleeping in the sand, or we'd go for months and months, you'd never know what it was like to sleep on a bed.
Yeah, but you weren't a young man, I mean, compared with the troops. I mean, you were now getting on for 40.
That's right.
Were you fit?
Oh, very fit. I must have been.
Yeah.
Must have been. I didn't.
But you had no health problems in the Middle East, did you?
No.
You hardly had any health problems in New Guinea, apart from some malaria?
That's right, BT and MPT.
Yeah.
But apart from that, no, I never had any other problems.
Yeah. That presumably accounts for part of the success of your mission, the fact that you were there with the boys for so long. The First World War chaplains, many of them only did a tour of about a year, then they'd go back, and the troops often referred to them as Cook's tourists, that they'd just come and they'd go. But you were there so constantly that you just became a part of the battalion, really.
That's right.
And your health was very important in that, I imagine.
Yes. Oh, it was. And even when I was promoted and appointed to New Guinea Force headquarters, I still spent the major part of my time with the frontline forces. The chappie that took over from me, Eddie Cooper, he was a lieutenant at the time. And well, I spent most of my time with Eddie Cooper down on the front.
You, of course, you'd made your mind up when you joined up with the army that you were going to stay with them until the war was over, hadn't you?
Well, yes. I would have liked to have gone right through to, the Declaration of Peace.
Was this the same with most chaplains, or were the chaplains in the Second War, like the First War chaplains, changing around a lot and moving back to Australia?
No, our fellows mostly were changing around and moving back.
Mm. How did you get on with the Padres?
Oh, good. Excellent. There was only one occasion, I don't know whether I ought to mention it, in Palestine, where I didn't have the problems with them, but there were two, and they wanted to run the rec huts. At that stage in training camps, if we didn't run the rec huts, we had nothing to do apart from meeting the needs of the men spiritually, or if a man had a problem with his girlfriend or his wife or that sort of thing, and they would come to us, and we'd often write to those people and try to sort of win them over, explain to them that this particular man or something of the kind was trying to serve his country and was away from home for that reason, and if he had his way, he would be home playing his part at home, and such like. But otherwise, our task was those rec huts. Well, these two particular padres, they had made life very difficult for my predecessor to the 21st Brigade, John Hocking. It resulted in John finally asking to be moved from the brigade, and our chief moved him. But Brigadier Jackie Stevens, who was the brigade commander at that particular time, to try and level things out and to make things tolerable for everybody, he suggested to John Hocking, the Salvation Army man, that he live in the area of the 2nd 14th Battalion, where there was a Roman Catholic padre, Pat Whelan. And Pat Whelan was a thorough gentleman. He was a real friend and a mate. We got on excellently together, and we worked together for the benefit of the men. But however, just as I was appointed to the brigade, the word came of a move down out of that area. The padres had taken over these rec huts in John's area, and John was confined to the 14th Battalion instead of also being responsible for the 16th, which he was, but seeing that he was living out of the 16th area, meant that the 14th, as they did with me for years following, they got the cream of the Salvation Army service. So the day before the move was to come for us to go down to Dimmer from Hill 69, it was only a few miles down the road, but it was preparatory to a move to the Western Desert. I went down the day before, and I went to the boys who were operating the huts. They had Salvation Army Red Shield signs on them. I said to these boys, "Now don't move those signs without my permission." So they said, "Okay." Well, the next day, these two padres, they arrived there, and they went to the huts, and I told the boys that they would take the signs down, and they put up the battalion colours. So the boy said, "Well, Mr. Moore has been in and he's given us instructions that we're not to remove them without his authority." And they said, "Oh, well, we'll see about that." So they went to the brigadier, and the brigadier said, "Oh, well, this old sore is reopened," sort of thing. And finished up that finally I hadn't been introduced to him, and he sent for me. And I stood on the mat, I suppose. I didn't know much about military procedure or discipline. I thought I might have stuck my head out too far, but the brigadier was quite kind. The first thing he said was that, "Well, Mr. Moore, you're going to be a busy man filling John Hocking's shoes." And I said to him, "Well, look, sir, I'll never fill John Hocking's shoes. He's a totally different man to what I am. John will get in 24 hours, where it'll take Albert Moore 6 months." to get. John was a talented man. He could sing, he was a musician, he could do anything. However, he finally said to me, "Now, what is your job?" He acknowledged his ignorance in that respect, and I said to him, "Well, sir, under these circumstances, I have nothing else that I can do but run these rec huts." I said, "They're filled with our equipment, tables, chairs, games. Everything that's in them belongs to the Salvation Army and the Australian Comforts Fund." I said, "You know, if you take me out of this job, well, I've got nothing else to do. You might as well send me back to Australia." So finally he said to me, "Well, what would you think if I suggest to the Padres that they visit the huts at night and meet the boys, and you run them in the daytime and at night, but you'll be there when they arrive?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I'd be very happy to do that." So that was the solution, and that's the only little problem that we had.
And that was a good compromise, was it?
It was a good compromise. They never came near the huts.
Didn't they?
We didn't see them.
No.
No. But at least they didn't worry me anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And from there we moved to the Western Desert where, well, rec huts were just a thing of the past.
Yeah, sure. Now we better move on, Albert. We've got you back to Palestine. You went from there to Syria, isn't that right?
That's right. Another miracle happened, Michael, on the way back. We left the Western Desert and we came back up through Palestine and through the area where the troops had all been training. But before we got there, Jock and I came through Alexandria and Cairo and across the Suez Canal. We're coming up through the west, through the Sinai Desert. It was, it'd become dark. We weren't allowed to use lights because of enemy observation. And I was driving and I became very tired. And finally I said to Jock, who was sitting beside me, I said, "Well, Jock, I can't drive much further. We'll have to find somewhere to park. You couldn't get off the road because you'd be bogged in the sand. And if you stayed put on the side of the road, well, you could strike a military convoy coming in the dark, and you'd be a heap of junk." But as we drove along, I saw something shiny on the side of the road. I said to Jock, "Did you recognise what that was?" And he said, "No." So I got out and I examined these things, and it turned out to be half a dozen sheets of galvanised iron. Mm. I don't know why, you know, in the midst of the Sinai Desert. How they got there, there was no other installations there for perhaps 100 miles either side of where we were. Mm. So I put these on the sand and I drove onto them. And that stopped me from bogging. And we then dug holes for our hips, and this probably 9-10 o'clock at night, and we just settled down there to sleep till morning. We'd had nothing to eat since early morn, and we couldn't see anything further till we got well up into Palestine. However, after about 10 minutes, I suppose, I heard footsteps coming across the sand. Thought, well, whoever could this be? German soldier? What? Ever. And then a Tommy voice. He could see better than I could, apparently, and he said to us, "You're going to camp there for the night, diggers." And I said, "Yes, we've had it. You know, we can't go any further." And he said, "Have you eaten?" And I said, "Well, no, not since early morning." He said, "Would you like a feed?" I said, "Oh, why not? Where can we get a feed here, like the cup of tea in the troop train?" So he said, "Well, if you'd like one," he said, "I can knock you one up in quick time." But okay, so he led us across to his tent, a couple of hundred yards away in the desert, and he set his blower going, got into his tent and closed the flaps so that no lights could be seen, set his blower going and emptied in some bully beef and other tinned foods, and in no time he had us a delicious meal on the table there. And you know, in Psalms, or what's it, 78:19 or something like that, we read, "Can God furnish a table in the wilderness?" And the Israelites were complaining because of their lack of foodstuffs in the desert, where after they'd Moses had brought them out of Egypt. Well, that was fulfilled on that occasion. This young fellow had us a feed in no time, right in the midst of the Sinai Desert. It was a miracle.
Yeah.
I said to him, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I've got a decoy aerodrome, decoy airfield." And he said, "Just after you go," he said, "I'll go out and I'll light all these flares along the desert, two long rows of flares," he said. "And the idea is that German bombers come across, they mistake it for an airfield, and they drop their bombs there, and some other airfield will perhaps manage to escape."
Yeah, that reminds me, Albert, of the story, the Rock of Ages, that that I read in your diary.
Yes.
Perhaps you could tell that story too.
Yes, well, that was after we crossed the Mad Mile. When we went up into Syria, I got a message from the CO, supposedly from the CO, Colonel George Cameron, that he wanted me to operate at battalion headquarters, which was on the other side of Merger Ewan. And so Jock and I set out, and we crossed the Mad Mile. Now, on that journey, we were the Vichy French forces had their sights on the Mad Mile. It was about a mile of mountain road along round the mountain, and they had their sights fixed on this, and they would dispatch a shell every time a vehicle passed over that road. They would dispatch a shell from their positions, hoping to gauge your speed and to get that shell to land just about where you happened to be at the time of its arrival. And they fired four shells at us on the route. The whole four were desperately close. The vehicle received dents from some of the shrapnel that hit us. And two bags of coffee that the boys had got for me from the French barracks on the Litani River when they captured the French barracks.
Mm.
They also got me a coffee grinder. They gave me these, and they sold my problems for coffee for quite a while. But I had these on the top of the bus, and they were perforated by some of the shrapnel that exploded from these 75mm shells. And coffee beans was trailing out along the road. When we got round the corner, the CO, Colonel George Cameron, came to me, from whom I had received the message from a Don R, and the Colonel came over to me and he said, "What brought you here?" He'd heard the shelling and he knew that something special must be coming over the road. He said, "What brought you here?" And I said, "Well, sir, I received a message from you that you wanted me here." He said, "I wasn't anxious to come over it because I'd viewed the shelling of vehicles from the mountain at Rouen." "Oh," he said, "I wouldn't bring you over that road. I never sent any message." While he was talking to me, Captain Ben Buckler came from where he was sheltering along this mountain road, and he said, "I sent for him." Ben Buckler was one of the most courageous officers and most efficient officers in the Australian Army. And he said, "I sent for him, Colonel." He said, "I thought he could go up the road and do what he could for A Company, who had been badly mauled by the French forces the day before." So the colonel said, "Well, okay, now you're here." And the colonel went back. There was nothing there for battalion headquarters apart from a few officers and men and a shelter alongside this cleft of rock. However, I was just about to, Ben Buckler directed me where to go to A Company, and I was just about to set going again when, as I started the motor of the vehicle, the colonel came across. He said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going up to A Company." He said, "No, you're not." He said, "That's under fire, that section of road, the same as the Mad Mile is." So he called Ben Buckler over and he said, "He stops here till dark, and said after dark you give him a guide and direct him up to where he's got to go." So that was okay, and we went up. The guide came along. As soon as it got dark, I gave the boys coffee and comforts while we were waiting to go, and the news from the BBC. And then he took us up there, and we went round the road to A Company, and it was dark then, and the day was finished. So Jock and I selected a huge rock on the side of the road, and that was to be our abode for the night. Jock slept behind one of them, and I slept behind the other, just on the side of the road. The 2nd Sixth Field Artillery were just behind us, and well, they were shooting most of the night in spasms, sending 25-pounders over onto the shell, onto the French positions. The French didn't fire at night, so they didn't want to reveal their positions. And, well, we were there. We operated there for a day, a couple of days, until A Company were able to regroup and got a few reinforcements, and they went on their way. And so we moved back to battalion headquarters. And as soon as we arrived, the French bombarded that position of battalion headquarters. And after the first bombardment, the colonel came to me and he said, "I blame you for this." And I said, "Why is that, sir?" He said, "Well, when you came over that mad mile," he said, "the French, in a vehicle like you were driving, they concluded that in that vehicle there was no lesser officer than the brigadier, probably the general. And he said, they're out to get him." He said, "They don't know there was a Salvation Army officer driving the vehicle." Well, they bombarded that position for several days, bombardment after bombardment. And then during the middle of it, as you asked me a little while ago, the Rock of Ages, when the bombardment would come, we'd have no other shelter than crouching beside this great cleft of rock which ran down that road for probably 100 yards. And that was our protection. If that hadn't been there, we would have been killed without a doubt. And a lad from who was a choir boy with my son Kelvin at Christchurch East St Kilda in Melbourne, Kenny Clark. Now, Ken was crouching alongside of me, and we were almost sort of crouching on top of each other to get protection under this cleft of rock. Ken said to me, "Mr. Moore, this rock is a rock of ages to us today." And it sure was, Michael. If that rock hadn't been there, there would certainly have been deaths. I was wounded in the thigh, not a severe wound. I was too much of a coward to go and have it dressed because I believed I had to go over the mad mile.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the courage.
Was that the most dangerous situation you were ever in?
I would think so. Yes, I would think so.
And you'd had a close friend killed, Scott Palmer, there.
That's right. Bandmaster Palmer from Salvation Army, bandmaster from Perth, West Australia.
Yeah. Did that upset you, his death?
Well, yes, it did, because he had discussed with me a premonition that he'd had from a boy. I might have told you about it, might even be in my diary. But when he was a boy, he had a premonition that he was going to be killed on a field of battle. He used to tell the boys that he played soldiers with. When he got married, he told his wife that he warned her that the day would come when he would be killed on the field of battle. And when the battle was raging around, I think before Sidon fell, Blue Palmer, Herbert, I think his Christian name was, and his brother Mick were a stretcher bearing, as bandsmen usually do in fighting conditions. They become stretcher bearers. And Blue and Mick were walking down a ravine to the Damore River. And as I say, the fighting had gone on. Mick says that he never heard a shot, he heard nothing. But Blue just grabbed his stomach and collapsed at Mick's feet and said, "Mick, I'm shot." and he died there at his brother's feet.
Mm.
And he discussed with me the first time I did a meeting with the Perth Fortress Boys in Palestine. Blue followed me out of the meeting, and he discussed with me this premonition that he had.
Mm.
And he said, I'm not going home, Al, but he said, I'm going to be killed over here.
Mm.
And I tried to talk to him and reassure him and all that sort of thing, but I didn't accomplish anything, and Blue died there on the field of battle.
Mm. Well, I think we best move on. You came back to Australia in early 1942, and you were something of a celebrity when you arrived back in Melbourne, really, weren't you? You brought your van with you.
That's right, and that was a great thing. Could I just mention the series of 13s on our way back? We came back via Port Tewfik in Egypt, and we boarded the big French vessel Île-de-France there. We came to Bombay without incident. Now, the position had reversed. When we went over from Bombay or Colombo going to the Middle East, we transshipped into small ships for that area between those ports and Port Suez because of the danger in those areas. On the way back, the position was reversed and we transshipped into smaller ships at Bombay for the journey in to the area wherever we were going.
You weren't sure where you were going, were you?
No, we had no idea where we were going.
You hoped you were going back to Australia, but
yes,
you weren't certain about it.
I'd put a big map on the boat, and the boys, a lot of money was changing hands as they followed the route on this map all the way to Australia. And
did you frown on that, gambling?
Oh, no, I thought boys will be boys.
Yeah.
We were not supposed to handle playing cards.
Yeah.
But I could see the value of playing cards to these fellows, and under those circumstances, while two rights don't, at least two wrongs don't make a right, I acknowledge that, but I felt that the blessing that could come to a fellow with a pack of cards, and a couple of fellows, outweighed any little resentment that we might have against doing that sort of thing, same as smoking cigarettes.
Did you take the same approach to drink too?
Oh, well, no, I never ever touched a glass myself.
Mm.
In fact, one of the sisters on the Lancashire, she invited me to, I suppose I should have invited her to have had a drink, but if I had, she was talking to me and I would have bought her lemonade, and that mightn't have suited her.
Yeah.
And when she finally invited me to have a drink, and I said, oh, I'd have a lemonade, and she said, oh, I won't ask you to have a drink again.
Yeah.
But however...
But you didn't mind the boys drinking?
Oh, well, no, I couldn't say that. It didn't worry me, Michael.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't worry me. I don't like... My dad drank quite a bit, and, well, I can honestly say, if you put a glass of beer on this table now and put $1,000 alongside of it, I would not in any way be tempted to drink that glass of beer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my mum said to me, Albert, never take the first glass and you'll never be in trouble.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've observed that right to this very day, that I would not be tempted under any circumstances. Officer's mess or that sort of thing, I'd never be tempted. I'd always drink a soft drink.
Yeah. Did you, you were not a wowser yourself,
oh, no.
you know what I mean by that, but did you come across chaplains who were and who in fact might have lost a way of dealing with the boys if they frowned on their, you know,
to no,
many
I don't
ways.
Think so.
You didn't? No.
No.
That was certainly true in the First World War.
Was it?
But they lectured the troops in all sorts of ways as if they were children.
Yes.
And they lost the men's respect. I've come across a few stories.
No, I think there were lots of greater sins than those. I mean, the Bible itself says, take a little wine for thy stomach's sake. And I think that, in lots of ways, if men had never been drunkards, if strong drink had never been abused, there would not be the temperance societies that there are.
Mm.
It's just the abuse of any blessing that can make it a curse. And I think that, you know, that goes a long way. But these, when we got, when on the way, as we thought, home, we got to Bombay. We transshipped into smaller ships. I went on the City of Paris. Now, for anybody for being superstitious, we were due to leave, which we did. We pulled out of Colombo Harbour, Sri Lanka, at 1300 hours, one day, 1 o'clock, on the 13th of February, 1942, when I went up on deck out into the open ocean, I counted 13 ships in the convoy. We travelled for round about 6.5 days in the direction of Australia, but incidentally we were bound for Java. The morning of the 7th day I went up on deck and I said to the boys, you know, well, what's wrong this morning? We're on the wrong side of the ship. The sun is on the wrong side of the ship. And they said, oh, we're going back. We're speeding. Breakneck speed. And the whole convoy was going in the opposite direction.
That must have been very disappointing for you.
Yes, the warning had been flashed to the convoy during the night to fly back, rush back to Colombo. We'd left Bombay. The convoy that left on the 12th, the day ahead of us, went into Java and were captured.
Yes.
And lots of those fellows died on the Burma Railway.
Indeed,
other things. When we got back to Colombo, not Bombay, we got back to Colombo, I checked my diary, exactly 13 days.
Amazing.
So there was a series of 13.
Well, you got back to Australia, and you had a few months, didn't you?
That's right.
You had a few months with your family and so on, and you did a lot of work, didn't you? You travelled around a lot. You drove the bus from Adelaide to Melbourne.
That's right.
You packed it up the top of Bourke Street outside the Salvation Army Temple there.
Yes.
And
in front of Coles in Bourke Street.
You raised a lot of money, didn't you?
Oh, yes, yes, raised a lot of money.
Yeah, and but you wanted to get back with the boys.
That's right.
And before long, you found yourself in New Guinea.
Yes, we had probably a fortnight leave at home. It wouldn't have been that long, only my boy took had an attack of appendicitis.
That's right.
Just as I was about to leave, and so I sort of stayed till he was out of the woods. And then we left for, we went to Yandina. We were there for about 3 months. And then we left there to go to New Guinea. We left Brisbane on the 6th of August, 1942. We got to Port Moresby on the 12th. But on the route up, on the Saturday night, I think we left Brisbane about the Thursday. On the Saturday night, I'd arranged a concert for the boys. It was a hell ship. The Ile de France, the Lancashire, the City of Paris, the Queen Mary were all fantastic. But this ship was a Liberty, American Liberty ship, John Fenimore Cooper. And it was a hell ship. The boys slept in the hold, head to feet and shoulder to shoulder.
Good grief.
I spent half the first night there with them, but it was no good to me. I couldn't take it. That's one thing where the boys were able to take more than Albert Moore was able to take. I couldn't suffer it. And I crept out over their bodies up on deck, and I slept on the deck. I finished up sleeping on the roof of the improvised kitchen, which sloped down to the ocean. If a man had have sort of moved too much in his sleep, he would have finished up in the drink. But however, we had this concert, and the boys were the only artists, of course, and they contributed well, and it was great. Then on the Sunday, the CO, Colonel Key, asked me if I would do the church parade, which we did. There were 250 men and officers at that church parade, and I've never heard men sing like those men sang as this ship, terrible ship, ploughed its way through the waters up the Queensland coast. By the time we got to Port Moresby, half of us were down with dysentery, myself included. I would have been wheeled off in a wheelchair if that had been available, but there was none available, so it was a matter of struggle off. We loaded onto corvettes, and the corvette ran us into the pier at Port Moresby.
And you're in New Guinea then for 2 years.
That's right.
You were the furthest, you went the furthest up the Kokoda Trail of any chaplain or welfare worker, and you did the same work in New Guinea that you'd done in the Middle East, didn't you? You're providing coffee and comforts and a place for people to stop, to drop in, to write letters home.
Yes.
But your role became more administrative, really, didn't it? I mean, you were the senior Salvation Army man in New Guinea.
Yes, after the Kokoda Trail show, I wouldn't say that there wasn't chaplains who went further on the trail than I did. I wouldn't know as to whether there were chaplains beyond Myola. That was as far as I got till I was stopped from going any further during the peak fighting. Later on, when the Jap resistance ceased, chaplains could quite easily have gone over the entire Kokoda Trail, which I didn't do. I got as far as Myola. That was a six-day trek, which I did with my helper in five. One day we made good progress, and so we did a second stage, which was a bit foolish because it knocked the chaplain, my helper, out, and knocked the sergeant out who was travelling with me. But at Myola, we did what we could there. These native carriers that I'd managed to load up with comforts, they arrived there, and we distributed those comforts among the hospitalised men. There were no hospitals as such. There were just tents, and they were more or less tent flies over a slab of wood, over a beam. And doctors were working there under indescribable conditions, mud a foot deep. And lots of the fellows had had amputations, and they were suffering terrible wounds and such like, and lots of men down with malaria and such like, BT and MT, and all sorts of diseases of fevers, which shortly later, a few days later, they were put on their feet and told to go. And men who couldn't walk, of course, were just put on improvised stretchers, and it took eight natives to carry each man on a stretcher. So when we were able to provide a meal for the remnants of the 39th Infantry Battalion, they were militiamen, and they were the first. There was quite a, you know, a lot of controversy when these fellows were sent to New Guinea because they hadn't volunteered and they were a militia battalion, and they went. They were the first to meet the Japanese on the Kokoda Trail, round about Kokoda. And when they were relieved by the AIF, the 14th Battalion in particular, 2nd 14th, these fellows came back into Myola while Jock, my helper, and I were there, and the commandant of the camp, who stopped me from going on because he said, you know, it was just too dangerous and he wouldn't agree to me going on. These boys, and they're only boys, 39th, most respected fighting men by the AIF fellows, he said to me, well, these fellows are due back, they're coming back along the trail now. He said, and I won't be able to give them a feed. And I said to him, well, Commandant, well, Major, whatever his rank was, if you care to give me the supplies and the equipment, I said, Jock and I will provide a meal for them. So he did this, and we went out onto the dropping area, where planes used to dive down and they'd push the supplies out of the planes at that stage. We'll provide a meal, which we did. And when these fellows came in, I think Damien Pera's got a picture of them there. we met them and told them that if they came over to where we had prepared the meal that, you know, they could eat, which they did. And they were able to have a hot meal, which otherwise they wouldn't have got.
Yes. Marvellous. Marvellous work. You didn't want to leave New Guinea?
No. I wanted to stop there because I felt that there was so much still to be done, and I had so much in the course of operation.
Yeah. Why did the Salvation Army order you out eventually?
Well, I think Michael Lake felt I'd been away from home long enough. Yeah. I'd been away longer than any other Salvation Army officer.
Certainly.
And they felt, I think, they never ever told me, but I think they felt that probably I'd been away from home long enough, probably 4 years. I was in the Red Shield War Services for 5 years and 47 days. Then I went after I finished up in West Australia. I spent 12 months in Hong Kong.
Hmm. Was that with the family in Hong Kong?
No.
You went by yourself
my
again?
My wife didn't go. She could have done, I think, but it would have been a problem for my boy again, sort of taking him over there for...
Was she working with the Salvation Army while you were abroad?
Yes, she was doing lots of work, you know, for the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
When she was in Melbourne, before we went to West Australia, she used to go out on patrol of a night round Little Bourke Street and these places where United States servicemen would find themselves, and lots of young girls would be tempted to go and associate with them in those particular areas.
Mm.
And my wife would go with another Salvation Army Lassie officer, and they would try to rescue these girls from, you know, falling into a life of vice because of the circumstances in which they found themselves.
Yes, that was there was great concern at the time, wasn't there, for young girls?
Yes.
And some of them were very young.
They were, yes. And my wife, you know, and other women, they would try to get onto these girls and either take them home or...
So she was pretty busy while you were away.
Oh, she was very busy.
Yeah. Mm. When you look back at your service with the Salvation Army over all those years... Was your war service the most important part of your life, do you think?
Well, I'm human, Michael. And whilst there were lots of blessed experiences in being in charge of a corps where you've got a band, you've got a songster brigade, and you've got lots of good folk who are within the fold, yet there seemed to be a fascination for me in trying to do what I could for men who were making such tremendous sacrifices under most terrible conditions. When I linked up with the war services, when the Salvation Army selected me, I felt that this, whilst I knew what it was going to, or I felt I knew, I didn't really, what it was going to cost me in the loss of the companionship of my wife and my boy, who was about 11 years of age when I first went away. Yet I felt that I wanted to do something. I would have been the most disappointed man for the rest of my life if the war had gone through and I hadn't made a contribution to the war effort, and I felt that this was the most rewarding effort. There was never the same thrill. For instance, when we were in camp up at Yandina, I probably may have entered in my diaries about the lack of the same thrill under those circumstances as there was when you're in a war area where the need was so much greater. The homes of people in Nambour and Yandina were thrown wide open for these fellas to go and spend their leisure time.
Actually, I think that's right. In your diary, I think you were a bit bored when you were up there.
I was. Yeah. Yes, I was. I found that the thrill of actual service, the need wasn't nearly as great.
Yeah. Well, how did you adjust back into Salvation Army life then after the war? Did you find that a bit dull?
I did find it dull, yes. To be honest, and you know, to be human, there was a reaction. Even when I was appointed to Perth in West Australia, and I was appointed over there as a State War Secretary,
yeah.
I was the responsible welfare officer for the whole of the state. All the various camps where we had officers serving, it was my responsibility to visit them and check up with them. I had to drive long distances. I had to fly to Broome to check up with our man up there and this sort of thing. Even in West Australia, I had itchy feet.
Mm.
You know, I'd see troop trains go out of Perth and I'd want to be with them.
Mm. Did you keep up contacts with people you'd met in the army?
Not a great deal.
No. Well, I think you and I could go on talking about your war service for hours, and I know we can't do that because I don't want to tire you too much, but it's been a tremendous record of those years of your life, and I thank you very much talking to me.
Well, it is, Michael, and, you know, one of my ambitions is that the people of Australia might come to know more about what the Salvation Army did. As you said to me on the phone, it was an eye-opener to you. You never realised that the Salvation Army was involved in work like this. Mm. And perhaps lots of other people are not.
Mm.
And I have been, not so much of recent years, but early years, I have pleaded with our Salvation Army leaders to do something about publishing a book on the work of the Salvation Army, in the war years.
Well, I think it's needed.
It is needed.
As I said to you before, the two most famous chaplains or welfare officers of the First and Second World War were William Mackenzie of the First World War, known to everyone, and probably the most famous man in the First IIF, known to everyone as Fighting Mac, and I would think yourself in the Second World War. Both a remarkable tribute to the faith that you have and to the practical Christianity that Salvation Army embraces. And if I can help to publicise that work a bit with the book I'm producing, then I'll be very pleased. In fact, I've dedicated the First World War book to the memory of William Mackenzie.
Wonderful.
And I agree with you that that so much was done for men in most awful circumstances, and it's been an immense pleasure to listen to your story this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. That's very, very generous of you. I wouldn't certainly put myself as foremost in the Second World War.